So we have the parshas of Matos and Maaseh separate. This week Matos, next week Maaseh, and as far as I know, Chutz Laretz catches up with us. We meet up at the pass next week where they are both together. The opening section of Parshas Matos deals with the matter of Nidorim, of vows, quite a number of psukim, in fact. And I would like to focus actually on one phrase which appears towards the beginning of this parsha, which one could certainly say is a signature phrase that we need to actually follow up and investigate what is the specific connotation of this phrase. The opening pasuk of the parsha, Vayidaber Moshe el Roshei Hamatos Levnei Yisrael Emor. Moshe speaks to the heads of the tribes of Bnei Yisrael, saying, Zeh HaDavar Asher Tzivo Hashem. This is the word, this is the matter that Hashem has commanded, and the ensuing 15-16 psukim are the details of Nidorim, of vows. And the phrase which I would like to focus on is Zeh HaDavar. It's not a phrase that we find often in the Torah. It appears once in a while, and therefore we ask, what is the specific connotation of this phrase, Zeh HaDavar? Meshech Chochma discusses this matter, and he really leads us through ultimately all of the Zeh HaDavars. I believe there's a half a dozen or so in the Torah. And he prefaces by saying, we'll see it from the Psukim, and then the Gemara will state as much, that Zeh HaDavar generally introduces what is known as a mitzvah l'sha'a, a mitzvah that applies only for a particular time. This is in contrast to the idea of a mitzvah l'doros, a mitzvah which is given for all future generations. But Zeh HaDavar, and perhaps the specific nature of that expression, Zeh HaDavar, it's very, very exclusive, because it is exclusive to a certain time or a certain initial generation. Let us see this idea in practice and we'll get a very clear sense of what we're talking about. The first Zeh HaDavar in the Torah is in Parshas B'Shalach. It's with reference to the Man, the end of the section of Man. Hashem says, or Moshe says, Zeh HaDavar, Hashetziva Hashem, to take a flask and to put some man in it and to put it in the Aron. Of course, there wasn't an Aron yet at that time. That happened a little bit later on. And that was the mitzvah of placing the man next to the Aron. As a mishmeres, people should know there was such a thing called the man. In fact, the Navi Yirmiyah actually took it out in his time because people were saying, as Rashi tells us, that it's difficult, you know, parnasa and keeping the mitzvahs and learning Torah, it's difficult to do everything. And Yirmiyahu says, look at the man. And that's really what it was there for. If the Jewish people are on level, their parnasa will also work out. But this mitzvah is not a mitzvah ledoros, it's not a mitzvah for all generations. After that first generation, there was no man. I mean, it's not like tefillin, it's not like sukkah, which every year or every day or every week, it was specific to that time. And that's why the command is introduced with the word Zeh HaDavar, this is this particular matter. That's the first example. Second, moving to the end of Chumash Shemos, in the beginning of Vayakel, when Moshe discusses the donations for the Mishkan, Vayomer Moshe el Bnei Yisrael, Zeh HaDavar Asher Tziva Hashem. And what is Zeh HaDavar? Kechum Eitchem Truma Lashem. Everyone should take, should donate whatever they have, the gold, the silver, the materials, whatever it may be. Here too, the mitzvah of donating to the Mishkan was only for that Mishkan. There is no repeat in the Beis HaMikdash, not the first, second, or third. It was specific for that time, the idea of these donations, and therefore, again, as a mitzvah, l'sha'a, it is introduced with the words Zeh HaDavar, that's in Shmos Perek Lamed Hei. The final example before we get to the Gemara is from Vayikra, Perek Tes, the beginning of Parsha Shmini. As we know, Parsha Shmini, which was the day that followed the 7 preparatory days, the 7 days of the Miluin, and Yom HaShmini, first day of Nisan, had unique korbanos to it. And though, which were not did not exist beforehand, would not be repeated afterwards. Those korbanos are introduced or accompanied with the words Zeh HaDavar Asher Tziva Hashem. On this particular occasion, these are the korbanos that are to be brought. So Hatzad HaShoveh, the common theme throughout all of these cases of Zeh HaDavar is, as we say, they denote a mitzvah l'shoa, a mitzvah for a particular time, either for that one day, or for that one generation, or for that one occasion. And indeed, the Gemara applies this concept to another Zeh HaDavar, and thereby concludes that that was also only for a particular time. There is a section in the end of next week's Parsha, Parshas Maaseh, which is the section of Hasovas Nachla. Hasovas Nachla is, to describe in our words, although the Pasuk talks about it at length, is the idea that if there are daughters who inherit their father, they should not marry someone outside of their shevet, of their tribe, because if they do, then their ancestral holdings will go to the children of the husband, because the tribe always goes after the husband, and that would, in a sense, therefore divert or outsource the resources of the tribe to another tribe. That's called Hasavas Nachala. This was the complaint of Bnei Yosef. They said it relates to Tzlofchad's daughters, those 5 daughters. They inherited a great deal of land from Tzlofchad, and it was just them. So the representatives of Yosef says, if they marry from other tribes, that's the last we're going to see of this inheritance. And the directive was that they should marry from Bnei Yosef. We still imagine there was enough of a pool of eligible young men, but that was the requirement. And it is introduced with the words Zeh HaDavar again. And for this reason, the Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra and Daf Kuf Kaf, which is in the chapter of Yesh Nochlim, the 8th parak of Bava Basra, all about inheritance, the Gemara states, we see from here that that requirement only existed for that first generation. It's not an ongoing requirement. It's not an ongoing command that any time a daughter inherits, she has to marry someone from within her tribe. After the Jewish people were settled and consolidated, so then she can marry whoever she wants. That prohibition was specifically for its time. And the way we know this is from those words, Zeh HaDavar. So we see that the Gemara itself takes note of the exclusive or restrictive, shall we say, limited nature of scope from these words, Zeh HaDavar. In this case, understanding that that whole requirement was limited to that first generation. So far, so good. If we may say, we're 4 for 4. All of these Zeh HaDavars clearly end up being temporary, shall we say, in nature, related to a specific time. However, there are 2 exceptions. One of them relates to our parsha, which is why we're talking about it now. And let us take them one by one. There are 2 cases which the Gemara itself raises there in Bava Basra Daf Kuf Kaf, where it says Zeh HaDavar, but we know that they are ongoing mitzvos. What are they, and how can they be explained? Ask the Gemara. Firstly, Shchutei Chutz. What is Shchutei Chutz? We're getting a bit of a tour of Tariag mitzvos here. What is Shchutei Chutz? Parshas Acharemos tells us that if there is an animal that has been sanctified as a korban, it is forbidden to shecht it outside of the environs of the Mishkan, and later on the Mikdash. That's Bomos. I mean, that's related to that whole thing. That's Shchutei Chutz, to shecht outside. Says the Gemara, we have a problem, because we know that the prohibition of Shchutei Chutz applies for all generations, and yet it is introduced with the words, if you have a look there in Vayikra, Perek Tet Zayin, Perek Aleph, Apostle Aleph, Zeh HaDavar, Asher Tziva Hashem. How can you reconcile Zeh HaDavar, which it connotes temporary, with a mitzvah that we know is ongoing for all future generations, where relevant. So the Gemara answers this, and the Gemara says, well, if you look at the end of that section, it says clearly, Chukas Olam, the Deroseichen, an everlasting statue for your generations, and thus we know that it applies to all generations. That's that. So in brief, Shrut Eichutz also says the Hadavar, yes, but that's almost trumped, we could say, or overridden by the fact that it explicitly concludes Chukas Olam Dorasechem for all generations. The final case is our Parsha, Nedarim, because as we started, these words, the Dorim is introduced with Zehadavar, Shetziva Hashem, but Nedarim apply to all generations, not just to one generation or one time. How can you explain that? To which the Gemara answers, the halacha of Nedarim is derived from that first exception of Shchut Eichutz, just like in ways that we're not going into details, it's a Gezeira Shava, just like Shchut Eichutz is for all generations, so too Nedarim is for all generations. And that is where the matter stands. So if we can summarize, of the six cases, of the six Zehadovars, four of them were temporary in nature, as is in keeping with the connotation of Zehadovar, and two of them are not. They're exceptions, and we have reason to conclude that they should be exceptional. Either explicit words, Chukas Olam, or then associated with Chukas Olam. And that's how the matter rests. Well, I say that's how the matter rests. That's true for most of the Jewish people, but it was not true for Meir Simcha HaKohen, the Meshe Chochma. Because he is clearly bothered by the fact that you have this phrase Zehadavar. It so clearly has a temporary connotation, and it means that in almost all of the cases. So what are we to make of the fact that the Torah uses it in other cases where it doesn't mean that? So don't use it. It's almost like a non-practicing Zehadavar in those final two cases. So don't write it. And the Gemara doesn't talk about it. But the Meshech Chochmah is not happy until we resolve that at the end of the day. So why does it say Zehadavar, this transient phrase, if it's actually a permanent mitzvah? And that is why the Meshech Chochmah says, if you look deeper into these two exceptional cases, Shechting Korbanos outside and Nedarim, you will see that although, or whereas, as a matter of generality, they apply in all generations, but there was something specific that only applied to that generation. And in reference to that, it has the temporary phrase of Zehadavar. What is the aspect of these two mitzvahs that was unique to that generation? Well, Al Rishon Rishon, we'll take them one by one. There's only two. Firstly, says Meshech Chochmah, with regards to Shchut Eichutz, and here we are, our question is clear, and the Gemara raises the question, that's an ongoing prohibition. Why does it have Zehadavar? And we demonstrate that it applies to all generations, but why say Zehadavar? Says Meshech Chochmah, because there was a certain element of this mitzvah which really only applied to that first generation. What is that element? You know, there is an interesting discussion in the Gemara as to the circumstances in the Midbar under which the Jewish people were allowed to eat meat. The Gemara says in Chulin Daf Tet Zayin, at least according to one opinion, that what's called basar tava, stam to eat meat, because you feel like fleishiks, was actually forbidden in the generation of the Midbar. Anytime a person wanted to eat meat, they needed to bring that animal as a korban, if it was a korban-worthy animal, to the Mishkan. It's a very interesting situation. It only applied to that generation of the Midbar. After that, you want to bring a korban, bring a korban. You want to not bring a korban, don't bring a korban. But in that first generation, everyone is in such close quarters with the Beis HaMikdash, no animal could be slaughtered if it was not within the context of a korban. That's the concept of basar tava. So says Ramban in Parshas Acharemos, that has implications for the issur of shechting an animal outside the Mishkan. Whereas in future generations, it's only true if you designate it as a korban. Because if not, it's not a korban. But in the Midbar, you have no option but to designate it as a korban. And as such, there is a standing prohibition to shecht any animal, even if it's not a korban. And that's why it's stated as a prohibition across the board. All animals are subject to shchutei chutz, but only in that first generation where basar tava was off limits. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, now we can understand why the Pasuk uses the expression zeh hadavar in the context of shchutei chutz. The mitzvah generally applies to all generations, but to apply across the board to every animal, even if it has not yet been sanctified as a korban, only true for that time. That's a temporary situation. That's called zeh hadavar. The zeh hadavar has found its mark in that respect. Okay, we're in the home stretch now. Back to Nedarim. What is it about Nedarim that applied only to that generation? And here Meshech Chochma says, a chidush, as he is well capable of doing. It's interesting, just by way of preface, something unusual. I wonder if this is features elsewhere in the Torah. If it does, not common at all. Moshe, the Pasuk states that he presented this mitzvah to the heads of the tribes. That's unusual. Normally, if we may say, when it comes to mitzvos, it says that Moshe speaks to the Jewish people, Vayedaber Moshe al Bnei Yisrael. And here, he directs it to Roshei Hamatos, to the heads of the tribes. Why would he do that? And the Gemara talks about this, and Rashi does. But Meshech Chochma has a fascinating approach here. It seems that there's something about this parsha that applied specifically to the Nesiim. Recent history has seen the disaster of Baal Peor, that whole episode which is described at the end of Parshas Balag with the daughters of Midian, and the whole thing came to a head actually with none other than a Nasi, a head of a tribe of the Jewish people, namely Zimri ben Salu. He is the Nasi of Shimon. And what are we to make of such a situation? The Gemara explains the background to how things deteriorated, and they did so rapidly. The Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Kuf Vav states that the daughters of Midian, they did not at the outset approach the Jewish males and entice them. That wasn't long in coming. But the first thing they did was that they offered them wine, as if to say, to be hospitable. But enough wine let down their barriers, and one thing led to another. And the Gemara makes a point of saying, at that stage there was not yet a restriction on the wine of Gentiles. Later on, that becomes almost like a trademark of halachic living, stam yena. But at that time, there was no such restriction. And because there was no such restriction, there were no inhibitions, and people partook, and one thing led to another. Says Meshech Chochma, it would be a while yet before anyone banned stam yena. But there were certain people who it was instantly off limits for. If it isn't a general ban, they need to undertake to refrain from this. Who are those people? Roshei Hamatos, the heads of the tribes. As if to say, the whole episode of Baal Peor and the depths to which it descended were represented by one of their own number, a head of a tribe who was also partook of this wine and then was prepared to be involved with Cosby, etc. And therefore, as a response to this, says Moshe, there's a concept called the Dorim, and before he presents it to the Jewish people, he specifically presents it to the heads of the tribes, as if to say, this has particular reference to you because you all need to undertake to have a neder against what it was that led the everyone, Zimri included, culminating in Zimri, to that disaster. And that is why this particular neder, which was specifically for the Nesiim at that time, within the general parsha of Nedarim, that's why it says Zeh Hadavar. Zeh Hadavar, or as we've noted, always has a connotation of something for that particular time. What was it about Nedarim that was particular for that time? The neder that was for the Roshei Hamatos. And therefore, all Zeh Hadavars have been resolved. They all have an aspect of non-permanence, for a specific time. What's fascinating, I think, just to take a step back from this Meshech Chochma, is the the perspective that it gives us in terms of how the other Nisim, and there's 11 now remaining, how they are to relate to what happened with their colleague, with their peer, as if to say, we may have understood that their response would stop at condemning him and castigating him and repudiating what he did, and he did that terrible thing, and we have no part of it, and we don't sanction it. And the Meshechacha said, but that's not enough, because he was also a Nasi, like you. And therefore, the response on the part of the leadership doesn't stop by just condemning what one of them did, but then by setting an example and taking steps to ensure that it doesn't happen to any of them either. It's very interesting that the leadership, in a sense, needs to take that responsibility. And that took the form of this neder, which is why this parsha was zeh hadavar for the Rosh Yamatos, first and foremost, before being presented to the Jewish people generally. So that's quite a big chiddush. It's actually a cluster of chiddushim by the time we unravel it.
I just mentioned that the end, it mentions Ele HaChukim.
Right.
So it's similar to the question of Shkita, because that also mentions...
True, but that's Chukas Olam, the Dura Seichem. It's not so much the designation as a chok, but the time frame over there.
All right.
Good. Okay, so from Nedarim, from those two words which demand our attention for a while, Zahadavar, we move to the war against Midian, which was also part of the response. And I would like to just note something most unique about this war, and we'll need to set up a certain understanding based on the Chumash and the Navi, and then we will see how it highlights what was so exceptional about this war. And this is done through the comments of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky in his Perush Emes LeYaakov. And he takes us back to Parshas Yisro. Yisro, as we know, he comes to become part of the Jewish people, and amazingly, it doesn't take him long before he actually starts offering his ideas to Moshe as to what he thinks is not going well or will not end well and how it might have a better outcome. It's very interesting. I mean, just to pause and reflect for a moment, we may have been inclined to think that Yisro, he should be grateful that he's become part of the Jewish people. His job at this stage is just really to be quiet and stay in the corner and not get in anyone's way. But within a very short amount of time, he's actually offering his opinions to Moshe. And what does he say? You can't do it all by yourself. And he recommends that Moshe sets up a system. As we know, Sari Alafim, Sari Meos, Sari Chamishim, Sari Asaros. A whole pyramid, a hierarchy of those that are in charge of thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens. Now, what's interesting about this system, which he recommended as a judicial system, and the difficult questions, or the question should be first offered to the Asaros, the leader of 10, and then refer it up if it's too difficult for him, to 50, to 100, 1,000, and only the hardest cases would go to Moshe. Or actually, in Yisro's words, the biggest cases should go to Moshe. In the Torah's words, the hardest cases should go to Moshe. But it was a judicial system. As we know, that system did not survive. We don't even know how long it really took hold for, because rapidly afterwards, with the Sanhedrin as we know it, we never hear from these ideas again. Groups of officers over 50 and 100 were familiar with the concept of a Sanhedrin. Beis Din has three people in it. A larger Sanhedrin is 23. The great Sanhedrin is 71. And we never hear again from these ideas of groups of 50 and groups of 100. However, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, if you look through the Navi, you will find something very interesting. And if you don't know how to look through the Navi, it's good to know someone who does. And that for us is Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Because you will see that these ideas of Sarei Meos and Sarei Chamishim, they still exist. They just don't exist as part of the judicial system. That's not how a Beis Din works. But the concept still exists. Where will we find it? Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. There are two areas where groups are of significance. Number one, the army, and number two, the Kohanim. And how interesting it is that we find references within the army of Sarei Alafim and Sarei Chamishim, heads of thousands and heads of fifties, as if to say, you see that the breakdown of the army was actually along the lines that Yisro intuited, whereby a brigade would be something like 1,000, and then each unit will be 50. Where do we see this? Says Rabbi Yaakov, look and say for Shmuel. In Shmuel Aleph, Perek Ches, where the people, as we know, they were clamoring somewhat for a king, and Shmuel felt the time wasn't right yet, and so therefore he wishes to depict for them what life will look like if they do have a king. It's not going to be all as rosy as they think. And one of the things he says, you know, if there's a king, he's going to take your children, he's going to put them in the army. If you're prepared for that, he's not just going to do favors for you. And in Shmuel's words, Velasumlo, he'll take them and enlist them. Velasumlo, sorry, alofim, v'sorry chamishim. He's going to make them into officers in the army. You may see them once in a while. But you see the idea of sorry, alofim, sorry chamishim, it exists in the time of Shmuel. Those are Yisro's words. They still pertain. That's how the army is made up. And likewise, in Sefer Melachim, Melachim Beis, when one of the kings there, Ahaziah, he sends his troops to try and capture or at least engage Eliyahu Hanavi. This is the beginning of Melachim Beis. The pasuk says, "Vayishlach elav sar chamishim v'chamishav." He dispatched a officer over 50 and his group of 50 men. Once again, you see that in the army, that's how the units are broken down. And moreover, says Rabbi Yaakov, it's for this reason, and this might be something of a chiddush, but if you look at the census in Chumash Bamidbar, and we spoke at length last week about the countings in Bamidbar, you'll note that when it comes to the Shvatim, in almost all cases, there's one exception which Rabbi Yaakov actually deals with, but we can't get into that now, but it's the exception that proves the rule. All the numbers are rounded off. They're rounded off to hundreds or to fifties, which is amazing. I mean, statistically, it's highly unlikely, but it could be. As if to say, Shimon was such and such many thousands and such many hundreds, or in one case, and 50. Consistently. How do we understand the exactitude of these numbers? Says Rabbi Yaakov, since the census was in part preparation for war, to organize them into their groups, and because the groups are groups of 50, therefore you will find that they will always be represented, their tally will always end in a 50 or 100, because even if there it wasn't exactly 50, it was 67, that's how it ended up. But those 17, they're not going to be their own unit, they're going to be dispersed, Meshubats, as they say, into an existing unit, which means when the tally of units will always be 50 or 100. So it is a certain rounding off, but now we understand why, because they're accounted according to these groups. So those are the Sarei Alafim and Sarei Chamishim with regards to the army. What about Sarei Meos? Do we ever hear from them again? We do, because the Kohanim also had their groups. They're also a tzava of sorts. The pasuk talks about Shevet Levi also has a tzava. Tzava means a group, a host, and they grew together for their avoda in the Mishkan. In Melachim Beis Perek Yud Aleph, there is the only surviving scion of Beis David there is Yoash. He's a young boy. And the Kohen, Yehoyada, undertakes to protect him. They store him there in the attic. And he gathers together the the Kohanim to do so. And the Pasuk states in Melachim Beis, Perek Yud Aleph, Shalach Yehoyada, Vayikach Esorei Hameos, he gathered together the officers over 100. Where do they come from? Because the groups of Kohanim were of hundreds. And therefore, it's very interesting if we could just summarize. Yisro's vision of what the judicial system looked like was very short-lived, if at all. But the groupings that he mentioned actually did endure, whether it was because of him or not, we don't know. But those ideas still exist. Groups of 50 for the army, groups of 100 for matters of Kedusha, for the Kohanim. So far, so good. Why do we mention this in the context of a shiur on Parshas Matos? Because there seems to be now an exception to the rule. And as we see, sometimes you need to know enough in order to be troubled. Otherwise, if without this background, we'd let it go. We wouldn't realize something is up here. Because if you look at the Pasuk here, in Pasuk Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Yudalit, it states, so they've gone to war, and there's again, there's so much in this Pasuk and these Pesukim which we can't go into now, but just for this point, Pasuk Yudalit states, Vayiktsov Moshe al Pekudei HaChayil. Moshe became angry over the officers. He felt that they had not conducted themselves correctly. Again, the details are in the Parsha, but who are the officers? Sarei HaAlafim v'Sarei HaMeos. The officers over 1,000, the officers over 100. And now we will appreciate, we know enough to have a problem. Namely, why are there Sarei Meos in the war? After all, we've just established that when it comes to matters of military relevance, so the units are not of hundreds, they are of 50s. There should be Sarei Chamishim. Where does Sarei HaMeos come from? Well, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, to understand why the groupings were different here in this battle, we need to understand the nature of the battle. This entire war was unique. How so? It is practically in a category of its own. When we talk about the types of categories of war that we have, there's Melchemet Chova, and Melchemet Mitzvah, and Melchemet Rashut, and most of them are about conquering or defending either the Jewish people or the land of Israel. And the two are, of course, intertwined. But this war was about none of these things. Because, as the Pasuk itself describes, it is in Milchemes Nikama. It is a war of vengeance. The closest thing we have to this is a war against Amalek. But here you see it's not for territory, and it's literally to exact vengeance on Hashem's behalf. Or more accurately, Hashem says it's to exact the vengeance of the Jewish people. Moshe says it to exact the vengeance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But it's clearly over matters spiritual. It is a response to the spiritual damage that Benos Midyan afflicted. And by the way, evidence of this can be seen in Rashi, because who went to war? If we have a look in Pasuk Dalet, so the truth is that this army was not that big, 1,000 per tribe. But which tribe supplied troops? Elef lamateh, 1,000 per tribe, lechol matos Yisrael, for all the tribes. Says Rashi, who is all the tribes? Leravos, Shevet, Levi. Levi were also involved in this war. Now, if we know anything about war, we know that Levi are never involved, as the Pasuk itself states on a number of occasions. So now, the question is, so why is this war different that Levi also sent troops? But the answer, says Rabbi Yaakov, is because this war was not like any other. It was purely, one could say, spiritual in nature, in origin. If one may use the term very carefully, it's really what we would call a holy war, because it was exclusively directed towards the sin, as a response to the sin that had been inflicted on the Jewish people, instigated by Midian. And therefore, when it comes to matters spiritual, even Levi goes to war. Unusually. The next time we're going to see Levi go to war is in the Hanukkah story, when they're the ones who led the war, for the very same reason, because the oppression was one that targeted the Beis HaMikdash as the epicenter and emanating out from their Judaism. So the Hashmonaim went to war. Therefore, says Rabbi Yaakov, do not be surprised when you understand the nature of this engagement, that it was motivated as a response to spiritual damage, and therefore it was in a sense a spiritual response. That is why the groups here were not groups of 50, as is normally the case, but they were groups of hundreds, which is true for the Kohanim, because it was a holy assembly in that way. So it's amazing just to see the attention to detail bolstered by Rabbi Yaakov's knowledge of Nach, paying attention each time, where it's the 50s, where it's the hundreds, and if there's an exception, why it is an exception. Well, we come now to the final section of the parsha, which is the episode of B'nei Gad U'B'nei Reuven, and here too quite a bit to say, as we know, many, many psukim, and let us take a look firstly at matters of parshanut and see where we go from there. So this is in Perek Lamed Beis. We will not mention questions at length, but we'll let some of them come out through the discussion itself. We note, interestingly, that the two tribes who are the initiators here, the order is reversed, as the pasuk describes them, because in the beginning of the perek it says Umikne Rav Hayal Evnei Reuven Evnei Gad Atzumaot, so it mentions Reuven before Gad. That is the last time Reuven will be mentioned before Gad. From this time onwards, it's going to be Gad and then Reuven. Interesting. And that's how we always talk about it. B'nei Gad U'B'nei Reuven. So Reuven, he gets his one pasuk where he's first, but from that point on, it's really God that takes over. And one could say that the answer, as some do say, is really in the pasuk, because it says that if their motivation, at least in part, was because of their cattle, so it says U'Mikne Rav Hayal U'B'nei Reuven. Reuven had a lot of cattle. B'nei Gad had Atzumaot, had an enormous amount of cattle, which means if that's the motivator, then at a certain point, God were more took the initiative, so to speak. But it could be something else. If we look at Pasuk Beis, it reads, Vayavo'u b'nei Gad u'b'nei Reuven, we see straight away, it's already God, then Reuven, Vayomu el Moshe v'el Elazar ha'kohen v'el Nesiyah ha'eda lemor. They said to Moshe, to Elazar, to the Nesiyim, saying. So that's an interesting introduction. Vayomru lemor. it sounds like a double saying. And what's all the more interesting is, in Pasuk Hey, it starts Vayomru, they said, which is, so they just keep on saying. Because in Pasuk Beis, we've got Vayomru and lemor, and that should suffice. But within two psukim, we already introduced their words again. So what are we to do with all these Vayomrus? So the Al Sheikh HaKadosh explains, again, just in terms of the Parshanut here. Here is B'nei Gad U'B'nei Reuven. And they have this request. It's amazing that they put this request to Moshe Rabbeinu. After all, officially, everyone's meant to be going into the land of Israel to approach Moshe and say, we'd like to stay here. And that takes some doing. And it also takes some explaining. And the questions that will be directed against them are twofold. Number one, you're not going to get involved in the war. And number two, what about living in Israel? I mean, where did that go? And that's why B'nei Gad U'B'nei Reuven, it's clear that they need to present some type of basis for the request. They can't just say, we'd like to stay on the east side, is that okay? So what do they say? It's interesting to see their words, get their position from their own words. In Pasuk Gimel, Ataros v'divon v'yazir v'nimra v'cheshbon v'elalei, Usavam unavo uva'o. Those are a good 8-9 places, which is a lot of places. Especially as in Pasuk Dalet they say Ha'aretz Hashehik Hashem Lefnei Adas Yisrael Eretz Miknei. They're going to summarize it in Pasuk Dalet anyway. The land that has been conquered. So if you're going to summarize it, so how come you itemized it with all of mentioning all the names? What's behind that? But the point is, this is Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven's presentation of why they feel that it's appropriate and acceptable for them to stay on the east side. Namely, they feel, as the Pasuk says, Ha'aretz Ashehika Hashem Lefnei Adas Yisrael, these are lands that Hashem has conquered for the Jewish people, lands that he's cleared for us. As if to say, the Jewish people need a way into Eretz Canaan. Quite so. But they don't need all of these territories in order just to make a way through. The fact, therefore, says Bnei Gad Bnei Reuven, that Hashem has cleared the entire area, could that perhaps be taken as a sign? And we've got all this cattle, it's a land of pasture, the whole thing's being made available, and that's not necessary just to get us into Eretz Canaan. That's why we suggest that perhaps we can stay, and it's acceptable to stay on the east side. What about the war? Well, here they say something very interesting. Because the way they describe the lands that have been conquered in Pasuk Dalet is Ha'aretz Asher Hika Hashem Lifnei Adas Yisrael, the land that Hashem has conquered before the Jewish people. Now that's a very interesting thing to say, because what they're trying to say is that, you know, we've seen from our own experience that the success in the war had no bearing on who was involved in the war, how many people went to war. It's clear as day that through these miraculous occurrences, Hashem has cleared the place, which means apparently he doesn't need us. That's why they're originally thinking they don't need to go to war. And interestingly, says the Al-Sheikh, this is why at a certain point God took over. You see, God have a reputation, and you see it from the beginning. God were fierce warriors. And you see it in the bracha of Yaakov. God gedud yigudenu v'hu yagud akev. I mean, they were very, very capable fighters. And therefore, there's more, in a sense, credibility for God to take the lead at a certain point. So it shouldn't be interpreted that they don't want to go to war, because God always liked to go to war, if relevant, if necessary. But their point is, it's not necessary, because Hashem is basically winning the wars for us, so we can stay here. Now, and all of this, by the way, again, just to make sure we don't lose track of the psukim here, all of this was before they actually make their request. And that is why Pasuk Bey says, Vayomru Lemor, they said to say. Meaning they said the following to Psukim in order to say what they actually wanted to say. Which doesn't come until Pasuk Hey, where they say, Al Tavirenu Esa Yarden. However, Moshe certainly reacts to the point of the war, because he says, and on the contrary, if God doesn't go in, and God are the strongest fighters, those that are not as strong as them, their resolve will be weakened. And therefore, says Moshe, it's not acceptable for them not to go to war. Rather, and at this point, if we may summarize, because there's some 30-odd psukim in this parsha, it's really a long, it's a lot of psukim. But if we look from Perek Tet Zayin to Pasuk Yud Zayin, when Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven realize that they will need to go to war, they offer to go to war. And they say, we'll build enclosures for our animals, homes for our families, and we will go to war. They'll be here, we'll go to war first. That's Pasuk Tet Zayin and Yud Zayin. Now Pasuk Kaf to Kaf Dalet is Moshe, in a general sense, reviewing what they said and holding them to it and saying, yes, you need to build things for your families here and then go to war first. So he seems to be reiterating what they said. And then in Pasuk Kaf Hei and Kaf Zayin, they then repeat what Moshe said and said, yes, we'll do it, we'll go first and we'll stay there until everything's been settled, then we'll come back. So there's a lot of everyone saying what the other one already said. So why all these repetitions? And although there's many nuances here, but I'd like to open up the question by looking at Pasuk Kaf Hei and Pasuk Kaf Zayin. Because, and this is when they review Moshe's review, so to speak. Pasuk Kaf Hei, Vayomer Bnei Gad Bnei Reuven and Moshe Lemor, Avadecha Yasu Kasher Adonai Mitzaveh. We'll do what you command us. They'll stay here, we'll go to war. Pasuk Kaf Zayin, Vavadecha Yavru Kol Chalut Tzava Lefnei Hashem L'Melchama. We'll go first. Kasher Adoni Dover, as you say. And what's interesting is they use almost the same expression in terms of their agreeing to Moshe, but it changes a little bit. In Pasuk Kaf Hei, they said that they will do that which Moshe commands. Kasher Adoni Mitzaveh. In Pasuk Kaf Zayin, they say that they will do Kasher Adoni Dover, that which Moshe says. And the question, of course, is what is Moshe commanding and what is Moshe saying? What's Mitzaveh and what's Dover? And the answer, says Al-Sheikh, is that there were actually two things. Moshe is correcting B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven, even in terms of their suggestion, at the same time that he's accepting their suggestion, but he's also correcting them in two things. The first is actually well known, because they say, we'll build enclosures for our livestock and cities for our families. Those are their words. Gidros son nivna lebikneinu, varim letapeinu. That's in Pasuk Tet Zayin. But when Moshe reviews their words, he says, in Pasuk Kaf Dalet, Benu lachem arim letapchem ugederos letzonachem. Build cities for your children and enclosures for your livestock. He's not repeating their words. He's rearranging their words. Because Moshe is saying, for whatever reason they felt that it was appropriate, it is inappropriate to build enclosures for their livestock before he has settled their families themselves. That's number one. And therefore he's actually telling them to reverse the order of what they suggested. And that is why, when they're in their final iteration, in Pasuk Kaf Hei, they say, Avodecha yasu kasher adoni mitzaveh, we'll do as you command, namely, Pasuk Kaf Vav, tapeinu, neshenu, mikneinu, v'chol behemteinu, yusham b'riyah gilad. They mention their family before their asset, as if to say, we said we do it that way, you told us to reverse it, and we will do it the way that you told us to do it, in that order. That's a tzivui. That's a command. So what's left? There's one other thing. As we mentioned, initially, their move not to be involved in the war is because they say, well, Hashem is running the war, so we don't need to be involved. Ha'aretz asher hikra Hashem. Hashem has conquered that territory. Now, Moshe says, it's not acceptable for you not to go to war. And they accept. But in accepting, there was a point of misunderstanding. As if to say, for B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven, at the risk of oversimplifying, at this initial stage, it's almost like a pendulum. It's binary. It's either Hashem is in the war, or we're doing the war. They didn't see there's room for both. And that's why originally they thought Hashem is doing the war, so we don't need to be involved. But when Moshe says, no, you've got to go to war, so they said, okay, we're prepared to. It's God. Right, B'nai Gad, they prepare for war, but then they understood, okay, so if from now on we're going to be in the war, then apparently Hashem is not going to be in the war, and we're okay with that, and we'll do our part, we'll take care of it. And that's why, look at what they say in Pasuk Yud Zayin. V'anachnu nechaletz choshim, we will go resolute, lifnei B'nai Yisrael, we'll go before B'nai Yisrael. There's no mention of Hashem in that Pasuk, because they understood, Moshe says, if you're going to go to war, so you're going to run the war. So if we're going to run the war, we will. And we're prepared to do it. For some reason, Hashem is not going to run the war. We will. That's okay. But that also is a mistake. And it's a mistake that Moshe praises them of in Pasuk Kaf. Because what they didn't realize is that at the end of the day, human endeavor and divine blessing are not mutually exclusive. They are complementary. They synergize. And that's why, as Moshe is seemingly just repeating what they're saying, he's not. He's adjusting that also. Look at Pasuk Kaf. Vayomer aleh Moshe, im tasun es hadavar hazeh, im techatzu lifnei Hashem b'milchama. You've got to go first in war. But unlike what you're saying, that you're going before the Jewish people, it's not that. You're going before Hashem. He's going to be there also. And that was a breakthrough in a sense. Because the point is, the two combine. You can't win the war without Hashem, but you've got to be there. And that's how the two go together. And that is why in Pasuk Kaf Zayin, as they conclude their final iteration, they say Va'avadecha Yavru Kol Chalutz Tzava Lifnei Hashem LaMilchama Kasher Adoni Dover. That's the second correction that they accepted. We will go, we're prepared to go first, but unlike the way we originally said it, that we'll be going before Yisrael, and you corrected us that we're going before Hashem, we understand that's actually the way it's happening. The way you said it, this is not a command, because it's a perspective, but it's a key perspective. And that's what here they said, Kasher Adoni Dover. And among the many other lessons here, we see once again how the two go together. The war, it's not either or. It's both together, and that was the lesson that's imparted on this occasion. Much more to say, but we'll leave it over here for this evening.